Welcome back to Culture Drop. I'm your host, Jed, and I'm joined once again by author and cultural critic, William Devitt, where today we're trying an interesting musical exercise where probably an ongoing series, one of us is going to introduce the other person to music they may not be that familiar with and get their reactions to it. And today it's Kimmy Dawson. William has been a big fan of Kimmy's work and sent me a bunch of tracks to react to. And I took a bunch of notes and we're going to discuss. So make yourself a tasty beverage, kick back, and enjoy the conversation.
Where are we at? What are we talking about?
Kimmy up. You sent me Kimmy Dawson songs. What was your rationale there?
I was going to just send him stuff and see what you wanted to say, because I'm tired of hearing myself talk. I was wondering what you thought about it.
Yeah, well, interesting. I made some notes about each of these songs. Just overarching comment. You know, the songs you sent are all pretty lo-fi type of recordings. She probably recorded it herself with acoustic guitar, her voice. And I was trying to place it, like, why does this sound familiar? And reading about her, she actually had the soundtrack to the Juno. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
Yeah.
She had some songs in that soundtrack, which was like a number one soundtrack, and it won a Grammy, so she had some acclaim, even though she's doing this very lo-fi type of aesthetic, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I got into her before, a couple of years before the movie came out, 2003, around there, 2002. Courtesy of Radio K.
Oh, okay, interesting.
You know, working on a job, and they played two different songs, and the current hadn't started up yet, and Radio K is still going. I think they even have an FM frequency the last couple of years mm-hmm. now too. And for my money, one of the three best radio stations in Minnesota. When the Juno movie came out, that was written, I believe, the screenplay was written by a local gal too.
Oh, okay, interesting.
I think she wrote for like the City Pages. I can't remember her name.
Yeah, that does kind of ring a bell. The other thing just struck me, just overall, like aesthetically, it kind of reminded me of the Bob Dylan Basement Tapes, where like she's not afraid to just let her mind run free lyrically. There's a lot of brilliance in these songs. Like, she'll get very localized, you know, just talk about something happening with her friend or her cat or something on the dock or murder ballad, you know, someone got shot in the face. But then she'll talk about get universal and talk about like a hand coming down from heaven and kind of this nice blend of like very localized colloquial language and then like something on a grander scale happening in the same song.
The song Anthrax is one of the few good, not good, but great songs written about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a band version of that a couple years later, they call it the power ballad version with the full instrumentation. The language, the imagery, well, just in general, I haven't heard all her work. I had her first three albums and never actually heard her the Moldy Peaches album, which is her and a really young guy, young at the time, a duo. I've heard a couple songs from it. I was, oddly enough, just listening to the Basement Tapes, the complete sessions.
You know what I mean? How Dylan's like not afraid to just get completely ridiculous, and you're just having fun with words, and I sense a lot of that spirit in Kimya Dawson.
Yeah, which is why I'll make the grand statement. I think at least on some of these songs from her first three albums that she's, I'm going to say it, as good as Bob Dylan at his best.
Okay.
Well, you can't say that. That's heresy. That's a horrible. You are an ignorant person, Willie. You don't know Bob Dylan. You don't understand. You don't comprehend him. Yeah, I do. As much as there is to be comprehended, I put Kimya Dawson up there with him.
We can go through these. I made some notes for each of the songs. Should we just kind of go through them?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Hadlock, Padlock. You know, there's kind of this murder ballad aspect to this song. There's this really cool line. Seven walls go up for every one wall that comes down, which is a really cool lyric. She does like a double track vocal. You know, even though it's lo-fi, double tracking your vocal can add a lot of power. And there's a flute in this song, which reminded me of Going Up the Country by Canned Heat, which I know is a song you don't like, but this song reminded me of that song because of the flute.
Right, right. And the quick tempo as well, yeah. Right. The first time I heard it, that came to mind with me as well. There's not a lot of flute playing in rock and roll. I don't consider Jethro Tull to be rock and roll, so.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Anthrax, I thought that was, I didn't pick up on the 9/11 thing, but it's a dream, and there's a really cool chord sequence. There's an angel watching over you, so just looking at the lyrics I jotted down, I can see how that would be related to that. And there was an anthrax scare around that time too,
right after 9/11. The air is filled with computers, Coke machines, carpets, firemen.
Yeah,
there's a whole list of things. It is, in fact, it's not a mystery song, sort of like the church's numbers, which I've always considered to be about 9/11, and they're the last band you would ever think would write topically about anything. And that's purely speculation, but it's still, for my money, it's about, it mirrors perfectly 9/11, but in a different way, in an apocalyptic sort of way, whereas Anthrax, the Kimya Dawson song, it's very specific.
Mm-hmm.
We turn on CNN, we watch the towers fall again, in Montreal, our van got broken into and they stole all my guitars. We realized our life isn't that bad. And there really wasn't much to say about it when, like Neil Young and Paul McCartney and all these sorts of people tried to, write songs. Embarrassing, what's wrong with you guys? And Jagger said at the time, he said, well, what we're going to hear is a whole bunch of really bad songs about people trying to cash in on 9/11.
Yeah. Okay, next, Kimya Dawson song, The Beer. I had noted murder ballad, shot in the head. There's this really cool line, like this boombox, like she's carrying a boombox on her shoulder and it becomes like a box of clementines. There's an out-of-tune violin, and there's some really cool lyrics about silver pink pony, kisses me, blah blah blah. I'm just kind of an interesting, kind of almost psychedelic murder ballad.
It's a song about extreme alcoholism, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's a young woman in the early 21st century United States, and the people that she knows, It's a Lou Reed song. Apparently, it actually did happen to her. She did. And it caused her to quit drinking. OD on alcohol and prescription drugs. And
yeah, I read about that on Wikipedia, and apparently, like, her situation was dire, and she woke up from her coma the next day, which was, like, unheard of.
Yeah, I just read that, too. I was looking up her discography on Wikipedia, and I read her full profile. But the words ring true. The people I knew, even though it's a younger generation than mine, it mirrors my friend came home on acid. I was holding his shotgun, dressed up like Tina Turner and Beyond Terror Dome. He said, "Don't shoot me." She said, "I won't. You're my friend. I love you."
Yeah.
And but the rapid delivery, mm-hmm. The rapping, is as strong as Dylan and Subterranean Home, Sick Blues, or, you know, any of other Bob's, you know, great songs that where he spits the verbiage out with a rapper's delight, to coin a phrase. Just the imagery. The pink pony thing is just, that's the denouement at the end of the song, you know. It's she's a professional, or she was, for, you know, or up until, you know, her early 30s, a professional daycare provider.
Oh, okay.
There's her whole raison d'etre, was taking care of little kids.
Okay, so that explains, like, these albums she's recorded for kids.
Yeah. And the one that she did, I forget, Alphabet, is hilarious. It's hilarious. And, you know, she uses, you know, little kids from her classes, from her daycare services, you know, backing vocals on it. And but it, they're all about what are kids into? What are little kids into?
Sure.
Farts, fart jokes, poop, falling down, slapstick, it's Kimya's, I don't even know how to put it. You could look at, you know, Robert Christgau's, you know, who can be annoying, but he's also a very good writer. You know, some of his ideas behind, you know, reviews of, you know, say her early albums, he'd be able to put it better than I'm able. It's earthiness and the ethereal combines to. She's not a bummer. She's not a bummer. She's writing, like, you know, the beer. Well, you know, the beer, Padlock. I mean, these are not happy campers in her songs.
Right.
You know, I mean, Headlock, Padlock, what's the line about, I went to the mall, got my Mazda, and I went to the mall, bought a big Johnson shirt, and, you know, my friends or my mom or friends or whatever told me to get you roast beef Mighty Bites, whatever those are, and out in New York State, outside New York City, and a pack of old golds,
probably like a Slim Jim or something.
Right. It's just, I know these people. I don't want to know them because they tend to be a miserable, godforsaken, desperate people, white or black. You know, Kimmy is black. It seems more real than all those, you know, hip-hop guys and so-called rappers, so-called hip-hop guys trying to keep it real and all that. It's like, no, this is the real thing here. And never mind.
Yeah, that's actually a really great observation. Like, current hip-hop, every time I hear it, it's so boring. You know, it's the same old stuff, and this is like much more real, much more interesting.
Well, there was a thing, I don't know if you recall, probably, you know, late 90s, early aughts, they called it backpacker, you know, hip-hop. And it was, you know, people like our, you know, local boys, you know, Atmosphere and, you know, Slug, mm-hmm. and Rhyme Sayers Collective. And for one thing, it tended to be much more lo-fi recording, tended to be more rhythmic, funkier, and just topically, the guys are just like, oh yeah, so, you know, I went to the grocery store today, and here's my story. Well, going to the grocery yeah. store, and then I called my girlfriend. Here's, you know, and just on my night, and but real stuff. That stuff didn't get on the radio. That was punk rock.
Yeah.
Of course.
No, I remember they played a lot of that on The Current at the time.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, and they probably still do. But you know, all this nonsense. I don't get me started about it, because it's, you know, the production values, and you know, topically, you know, I can listen to NWA's first album, which came out in what, 91. For its sonic quality and, you know, its sheer outrageousness and vulgarity. And, you know, Public Enemy is a, you know, whole nother trip, a whole nother, you know, production group, you know, the Bomb Squad. And, you know, that's a whole nother thing. That still holds up today.
That's right.
But as far as, you know, oh, you don't like rap? Yeah, I like rap. Yeah, I like Chuck Berry. I like Bob Dylan. I like Kimmy Dawson. Yeah.
Speaking of Chuck Berry, I saw this really interesting documentary last night. It was one of the producers was Mick Jagger. It came out like a year ago. It was on Jerry Lee Lewis. And it was all in his own words. It was just all vintage clips of him either performing in a concert or in a TV show, or him being interviewed throughout various stages of his life. And it's very well done.
Jagger did that. He did the James Brown biopic.
Right.
It was actually very good.
Yeah.
And the guy died. I forget his name. Died very young in the last like couple of years, last 2 years or something. And Jagger was the producer, not the director, but the producer behind it.
Yeah.
I didn't. I'll check this out about. Well, yeah, Chuck was, yeah, he was a clever mofo, you know. He was, you know, highly intelligent, articulate. I don't think I'd want to hang around with him any more than I'd want to hang around with Lou Reed or, you know, whatever, or whomever.
Chuck's an interesting cat, because clearly super intelligent, lyrically very astute, but he was definitely writing stuff to have hits. You know, he wasn't just trying to musically express himself.
That's why he existed.
Right.
Yeah, he said, what are the white kids going to want?
Exactly.
You know, the people on the labels are white people, but we know that the cool kids are listening to the, what they used to call very, until very recently, race records. So, what if I combine the two? What if I combine the hillbilly sound, the white country sound, and the Negro sound of the race records, and see what happens? And that's what the man did, and all bets were off.
That's what Jerry Lee Lewis did. Like, he kind of revealed his secret. Like, he grew up in this particular town. I think it was in Tennessee. And he would walk by, there was this one juke joint, and he would walk by, and he was underage, and he'd go, you know, B.B. King would be playing, or whoever would be playing, and he'd see people, like, how they were playing, and how they were playing piano, and he said, basically, like, his shtick, like, his Great Balls of Fire and all that stuff, like, the black guys were doing that, and he basically just copied that verbatim. And he's like, this is just freaking brilliant. This is what I want to do. And he just copied that, and it became huge.
Sure. He wasn't just listening to the sounds sonically. He was looking for how the music affected people, you know, visually, you know, physically, how they responded to it. So, you know, Little Richard was, he's already doing it too.
Oh, yeah.
And so Jerry Lee just, you know, I don't know who had a record out first, you know, Little Richard or Jerry Lee. These are weird people. These people have come from the church, you know, in their respective, you know, social milieus, you know. Jerry Lee Lewis's cousin was, who's the TV televangelist that got busted?
Jimmy Swaggart?
Jimmy Swaggart, yeah.
That was a cousin of Jerry Lee's.
A cousin, yeah. I thought he's,
there were three of them. There was Mickey Gilley, Jimmy Swaggart, and Jerry Lee Lewis were all cousins, and they all were brilliant piano players and singers, and Jimmy kind of like brought it to the church. Jerry brought it to the devil. There's this really interesting recording, like he made his dad drive him to Sun Studios, and like because he believed in himself so much, he's like, "Dad, you got to drive me to Sun Studios." And there's a recording of him arguing with Sam Phillips. He's like, "Jerry, you know, Sam, I've got the devil in me." And Sam's like, no, you know, this is like what the people want to hear. You know, it's going to motivate people. You know, Jerry Lee Lewis very much believed in like that fire and brimstone stuff. But at that, and later he became like, kind of like Little Richard, like embraced like Christian music. But at that time he's like, you know, I'm embracing the devil's music. This is what I'm doing.
Well, he's a crazy person, you know. The same way that Little Richard was a crazy person.
Yeah, and like very simple-minded, you know, not educated. He had a very kind of simple-minded approach to it, but such a vibrant performer. And like he had that crazy hair, and like you look at some videos and pictures of him with like, you know, he had that curly hair and his locks would kind of come down over his forehead. And like, he looks like he's someone from like 1979 or something. He's like kind of this alien way ahead of his time.
Oh, yeah, that's a good observation. Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, guys from 79, you know, Brian Setzer, you know, God bless him.
He's, yeah.
You know, great guitar player, great performer. That's who they were looking at. They were looking at Jerry Lee Lewis, Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran, you know, more so than Elvis.
That's right.
You know, when they were, you know, starting to.
Well, Elvis was viewed by like as kind of a fake, even by like, I think by those British guys and by Jerry Lee Lewis, even, you know, that Jerry Lee Lewis in this movie kind of said, you know, he viewed Elvis as kind of a, Colonel Tom Parker was the puppet master and Elvis was just the puppet, and he viewed himself as the real deal. Okay, so on that note, should we loop back to Kenya?
Yeah.
Okay, For Boxer. There's a drum machine on this song. And what's really interesting, you know, it's a song about her cat. Like, she gets really emotional at the end of it, almost like breaks down crying. And, you know, you and I are fond of cats, so that song really moved me. But one of the interesting things is there's a drum machine, but like the drum machine is not in time, which is a pretty spectacular thing for a drum machine. Like, how does a drum machine, maybe there's a person like controlling the drum machine. And it sounds, I noted here, it sounds like it was recorded at about 4 a.m. Someone who's under the influence of a lot of things. But that was before I realized, that's because, you know, she lost her cat. So maybe she's just heartbroken. But I just love that, you know, she's not trying to make it polished. You know, she's, and this comes through in a lot of her songs, you know, she's really just trying to lay it down, you know, just keep it real. And this is a great example of that.
Yeah, that's one of the two songs I heard on Radio K, and that's the one I heard first before the other, which was, you know, days or weeks apart. She had two albums that came out simultaneously in like 2002, 2003. Like her second and third album. And I'm hearing it, and there I'm painting or, you know, sanding or whatever I'm doing. And, you know, people like to talk about, oh, they heard such and such a song on the radio in their car, and they almost crashed their car or had to pull over or whatever. Well, I wasn't driving a car or whatever, but to say it gave me pause during the song.
I can imagine.
It did. I stopped what I was doing, and there was no one else around. I was just working alone for Slum Lord, and I listened to the, you know, the next few songs to hear who the artist was, and when they announced it, I think I turned the radio off and kind of sat still for a while and said, well, I'm going to try and find that record. And I did. But yeah, it had that effect on me. The drum machine thing, I think might be, I don't know if it's her. I think these were recorded in her bedroom, apparently. So whether it's her manually manipulating.
Yeah, it might be someone probably manually playing a drum machine. That's right. Why it's not quite
intentionally decays the meter decays at the end is intentional. It seems that she would not be that calculated. If she is that calculated, well then she's as brilliant as Prince. But it decays, she's decaying, and you know, ultimately just falls apart at the end of the song. It's an act. It's a very good, very convincing act. Maybe it is. That's what we call art, is short for artifice, is it not? You know, unless you're Keith Richards and you say, oh, art is something you put on the wall. This is work. Yeah, that's the first thing I heard by her. And, you know, lyrically, it's nothing. It's pure, unadulterated, and that's, you know, easy cliche terms to use, to throw around, but it's pure and unadulterated emotion.
Yeah.
And there's no screaming, there's no bellowing, there's no, you know, Whitney Houston histrionics or Roger Daltrey histrionics or anything. It's, that's all there is, that to say about that thing.
Yeah. Well said.
It's a big deal. We've both had, you know, animal companions die, and it can be as big a deal, if not more so, than human companions or friends or even family die.
Yeah, that's right.
Humans are wired that way.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful piece of music. Even though, in its ugliness, it's aesthetic amateurism. It's pure spirit.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. Well said. The next one, "Hold My Hand." That was interesting. It starts with this kind of like a lot of kind of ambient white noise, which is probably just down to the lo-fi recording of it. And there's this recurring theme about, you know, calling this social worker, who's kind of a jerk and not being very responsive to, like, trying to get help. And there's this really cool chorus, but the chorus changes every time. Like, the melody stays the same. It's like this catchy chorus, these catchy lyrics. And it starts with sometimes the world gets blah, 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 but then the rest of it changes every time she changes the words of the chorus. You know, it's about kids not being safe. And then what's really powerful is she's singing it with a kid. I don't know if it's her kid. kind of, they're singing like kind of in unison, and they're talking about holding my hand, and kind of them singing together kind of gives the song an extra kind of power.
Yeah, I'm assuming the song is just taken from her professional, her actual day job, which for
sure.
Year as she's a licensed daycare provider.
Yeah.
So it's very repertorial that way. It's a very matter of fact. There's no symbolism or anything until maybe the very last verse.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll call Oprah, you know.
That's right. There's this whole thing about calling Oprah, which is a really cool lyrical idea.
I'll tell her I'm fat and I'm black.
I'm fat and black. I'd written that down, actually.
Maybe me and Oprah can fix the CPS.
Right.
If you want to have a baby, they'll have to take a test.
Right. I had written all that down, actually, because that struck me. Another thing I had written down is that, you know, she's a musician, but almost more than that, you know, she's a storyteller. She's a great lyricist. She's a great storyteller. And, like, she's almost using the music as a vehicle to tell these really interesting stories about her life or her imagination.
I think she's as good a storyteller as Springsteen.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of our greats. And in fact, on another song on one of those first three albums, she actually mentions Springsteen.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bruce Springsteen, I was born to run. So I forget what the line is. I forget the song. I don't have those albums anymore. I just have a compilation CD I burned. I think she's as good as Springsteen. Just like I think she's as good imagistically as Dylan.
Sure.
And I'm not saying that to be, controversial or listen to this stuff. Oh, hey, that Willie, he's really onto something. As far as the chord progression, that's funny. You mentioned that's what they used to call folk music.
That's right.
Very subtle change, a very subtle chord change, and even just in a three chord song or two and a half chord song.
Yeah, the chord changes in that chorus are really catchy.
Very, very traditional. You've heard it a million times on other songs and other music in your life, and it's just there. It's the bedrock for what the singer has to say. And she, right. She's barely singing. She's just, you know, practically whispering, really. I think it's a pretty astounding piece of music.
That's actually kind of a nice segue into the next song, Will You Be Me, because there's a piano in there.
That's the other song, the second song I heard on Radio K. And just as a preface to your review, the DJ afterwards, he was obviously a young woman, and she said, That was Kimmy Dawson from her new record, blah, blah, blah. That is the scariest woman in rock and roll today. Like, what?
Interesting.
I can't remember if she said it before introducing the song or, you know, after the song or the block of songs. But I just remember them saying that, the DJ. And, as I've said, I went out and sought out, bought three albums all in one go at Cheapo. That little piano. It's almost like an eel thing, you know?
Yeah, it's a really clever little piano riff. And this one I actually would like to hear, like, recorded really well, because the piano figure is so cool.
Well, the guitar, is that a guitar? It sounds like an
electric. There's a piano and there's a guitar. They're both really... really cool track. So
does it not sound like a harpsichord, the guitar?
Oh, that's interesting. I'd have to go back and listen to it. There's a double tracked vocal, which sounds great. There's a piano, there's an acoustic guitar, and then there's really interesting lyrics. There, she talks about playing Pac-Man in the woods. There's this rapid fire, almost Dylan-esque fast word chorus. She's talking about, like, fight my crazies.
Drink my coffee, wear my clothes, fight my crazy.
There's like a cat that becomes a beam of light. A lot of fun lyrical stuff.
Line? That's again, her name. I think it's a dog maybe in the song, or maybe it's a cat. I reached out to pet her and she turned into a beam of light. Isn't that a beautiful?
Yeah.
Image. Carry on.
That's all I had to say about that song. The next one, unless you have something else to say about it, was Time to Think.
Just as far as the last song, You Be Me, the very last line, was it, bouncing and is so high, but watch out for the power lines.
Oh, that's great.
Unless you want to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's clever.
This is, your inner child, whatever. Nah, she's locked into her outer child. Anyway, that's all I got to say about that one.
And then the last one you sent, Time to Think, is a, it's got a cool piano. It's got...
There's piano in that one?
Yeah, there's piano in that one. There's counterpoint melodies, which, that's where you sing like two different parts at the same time. So it's very, whenever you do that, things get very complex and you have to be very clever to be able to pull that off. And she does in this song.
I think I know what you're talking about. Back when they had actual music classes in schools, which I don't know if they do anymore.
Yeah, you'd have two different parts going at the same time with different phrasing, but they'd all resolve like in the final line, and it's just so pleasing to your ear when that's done.
But they would teach children things like that.
That's right.
Row your boat, around they would call it.
Well, that's around. That's different. That's different.
I understand that, but songs that are didactic, they're instructive for a child to get attune a child's ear to melody, rhythm, counterpoint melody and counter rhythm. It requires a certain kind of concentration. I don't want to say a mathematical, even though mathematics is a big deal with music.
Yeah, well, music is mathematics, in the air. It's
much
sonic. We talked about last time, and that's what Kimya is doing in the Time to Think. She has like a counterpoint thing like that.
Some of those lines and references, Arthur Ashe and Billie Jean and Vonnegut at the university. She's just spitting these. It's like, Dylan is 66. She's spitting these lines out. I just love that. This resigned but hopeful, I mean, never mind playful, but actually hopeful quality to the song. Just, it's what a young person, it's everything to be young in whenever it came out, I think 2002, 2003.
The other thing with this song, it starts off with really simple words and like a silly kid song. You're like, oh, this is just a silly kid song. And I wasn't that interested. And then all of a sudden it goes into like, she talks about Saturn in soliloquies and she's using all these obscure words that kids wouldn't understand. So it tricks you. Like you think it's, oh, this is a kid song. And now it's a very complicated adult song. And so that makes it very interesting also.
Now, here's the thing, speaking to that, often spoken to, probably with you as well, but certainly to many, many other, friends and confidants and confederates who I'm able to speak about such things with, is that back in the day, as we used to say, or maybe they still say, children were expected to be intelligent.
Right, can you imagine?
As soon as possible. They were not. You did not look down, maybe look down on a child because they're just a bloody child. But your what they were given as food for thought and food for the soul was pretty advanced.
That's right.
Richard Adams' Watership Down, which is basically the Odyssey set in Lapine culture, which means rabbit culture, and not anthropomorphized rabbits, but actual rabbit behavior. The only reason they use the English language is that so people can read the damn book. But that was considered a children's book. And came out, I think it was published in 72, 71, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so music appreciation, it was a real thing. It was a real thing. I grew up with, you know, long players, which were, you know, all the rage, with, you know, little crummy turntables, listening to, Tchaikovsky and, the musical versions of Beatrice Potter's, you know, Peter Rabbit and Jemima Puddleduck songs. And so, or stories. So you get this cross-pollination, and then I'd turn on the radio and I'd hear, you know, the Four Tops, Sugar Pie, Honey Punch, or, you know, the Stones, you know, Get Off My Cloud, or the Beatles, I Want to Hold Your Hand, or whatever, and then go back to listening to whatever records that my parents would, you know, buy for us. You know, I have seven, you know, siblings, so it was, you know, a big family, and there would be music just all over the place from all different angles, all different cultures, all different time periods, including right up to the present. In, you know, grade school or middle school, as you want to call it, yeah, fourth grade, third grade, whatever, you're taught complex songs and complex ways of hearing music and singing music, like an inchworm song, or, you know, around, like Row, Row, Row Your Boat, or, you know, how to sing unison with a whole class of 20 kids, or how to sing counterpoint and harmony. This is an actual class that you had, you know, a couple times every week in grade school for 8 years. Do they have this anymore? You know, right. In public schools, parochial schools, this is a big deal, Jed. This is a big deal.
No, I agree.
Had you heard of Kimmy Dawson, or were you familiar with her?
I knew the name. You're looking her up, she looks familiar. Like I said, I definitely knew her stuff from the Juno soundtrack.
Okay.
But I never, like, seriously, like, just sat down and listened to her music, so it was an interesting musical exercise.